hard to walk on a social safety net. You can't really walk. You can walk on a social protection floor.
Welcome to this podcast produced by the International Monetary Fund. I'm Bruce Edwards, and in this episode, making social programs work for workers.
I'm Deborah Greenfield, and I'm the Deputy Director General for Policy at the International Labour Organization in Geneva. The ILO celebrates its 100th birthday this year. We were born out of the Paris Peace Conference at the end of World War I, where those who negotiated the peace treaty recognized that social justice was a key ingredient to achieving lasting peace.
While the work environment has changed dramatically in 100 years, gaining access to basic social programs remains a struggle for far too many workers around the world still today. A recent ILO study says more than half the global population lacks healthcare and social security. Deborah Greenfield joined a panel discussion on social spending during the IMF World Bank annual meetings.
Would you say that workers generally today are less organized, less represented than they were even perhaps like 10 years ago?
I think that that varies country by country and region by region. In some countries, we've seen a sharp decline in the rate of unionization, and that's often the political and the legal environment in which workers face so many challenges to organize. In other countries, though, in which we work with our social partners, with workers and their representatives, as well as employers and their representatives, we see the development of capacity to organize, to engage in collective bargaining, to advocate for their own needs and their own rights in the workplace. This, of course, has to be accompanied by the right legal framework, not just on paper, but in practice. And so we work with governments as well as our social partners to ensure that there is an environment in which freedom of association can be realized.
Mm-hmm. And what is the impact of this ability to organize on workers' access to things like healthcare and education, basically, social programs?
What we see is that as workers organize, as they have voice, as they're able to engage in social dialogue and collective bargaining, their own working conditions improve. And of course, that includes social protection and achieving social protection floors, because they're able to engage in what we call social dialogue. That is, they're able to engage in policy formulation and policy discourse with governments and with employers. So really, without that push on the part of workers, we won't achieve the kind of universal social protection that that our own constituents have told us is so important to achieve.
Mm. And so there are so many workers now that are on contract, that are not necessarily full-time employees of companies that provide benefits. How do we make the economy work for these workers who, in fact, are actually making the economy work?
Well, that's a huge question, and it has many, many answers. But I would say, to start with, and the panel this morning on the IMF social spending framework touched upon this, we should not equate the end of the employment relationship with the increase in part-time and temporary work. In fact, there are new business models that rely increasingly on part-time work and temporary work. However, those workers have an employer. Mm-hmm. And so what we need to do is to adapt our social protection schemes to make sure that everyone is covered. But we can still rely on what we call social insurance, that is, contributory mechanisms on the part of employers and workers. Their benefits need to be portable as they move from employer to employer, and we'll see more of that as we see the world of work changing. We can use technology, though, to help account for workers' contributions and employers' contributions and keep account of how those accounts really have grown as people move from one job to another. So we still think that the social insurance aspect of social protection is not only viable, but necessary, because we don't see that the taxation system is adequate enough in most countries to support the kind of universal social protection that our constituents have told us is the goal.
And you mentioned today during the panel that the ILO likes to refer to social spending as social investment. It seems that it's kind of a hard sell to governments that don't have a lot of resources and that have to make choices as to where their money is spent. How do you make the business case for more social spending to governments that are struggling with tight budgets?
I'm not convinced that it's such a hard sell in low-income countries. I think it's a harder sell, perhaps, in some advanced economies that don't and have not bought into the concept of universality. I think that countries that are struggling to move up the value chain, for example, that are struggling to bring men and women and children in that country to a level of sufficient self-sufficiency and health, understand that they have to invest. It's an investment and not just an expense, because without a floor underneath you, you can't really walk. So if you look at the difference, it's hard to walk on a social safety net. You can walk on a social protection floor. And I think most countries that are trying to figure out how to move towards the SDGs, how to move themselves up the economic ladder, understand that they need a population that is supported through the many transitions that they will go through and that are able to take risks, for example, to skill and reskill without falling into poverty. That they know that when they retire, there won't be a huge drain on the public fisc because older people have no health care. They understand that demographic changes require the kinds of investments in social protection that will allow people to develop their capacities to become full and productive members of society, able to engage in meaningful work. And it starts with healthcare at a very early age. It starts with maternal healthcare.
And so how do you see technology playing into all this? Do you think that this will eventually improve the lot of the worker, or do you see it as a threat?
Well, if you're asking whether technology is a threat or an opportunity, I would say it can be a bit of both. But we are increasingly looking at this not so much in a deterministic way, but as a question of policy choices. While it is true that many jobs will disappear, it's also true that many jobs will be created through technology. And while artificial intelligence may do what people can't do, there is a lot of work that people will continue to do. And so the challenge is to harness technology to create more and more conditions for decent work. We see technology being able to help workers monitor their working conditions. We see technology being able to facilitate the portability of benefits, not just from one job to another, but even from one country to another. So it's thinking creatively and innovatively about technology that we think is very promising. And we are working on innovation labs, setting up innovation labs and innovation hubs so that we can really explore how we use technology. And of course, it's also vital for small and medium enterprises to be able to use technology so that they can move up the value chain as well.
So technology as a means to fund perhaps the social programs.
Or to foster the growth of social programs, to facilitate their success. Yes.
And you mentioned as well today that what I thought was interesting was the importance of bringing in the private sector when it comes to finding ways of funding social programs.
The private sector has a key role to play in funding social programs. First of all, the very basis of contributory social insurance, in which employers and workers are contributing where they can, is that the private sector contributes towards a kind of social cohesion. They benefit from workers. there is a short-term cost, but a long-term benefit. But the kind of contributory social insurance that we promote as a basic ingredient to establish social protection floors, which does rely on the private sector, really builds social unity and social cohesion by spreading risk across society. So it is one way in which societies come together to take care of their own. But also the private sector is a key player in coming up with solutions.
And so how do you see international financial institutions and organizations such as yours, the ILO, supporting governments and supporting the private sector in trying to establish better social protection programs?
I think that we've now reached a point where we can move from the what to the how. That is, there is an agreement that inequality is the key issue. So at the IMF, inequality is seen as a macro-critical issue. Mm-hmm. At the ILO, inequality is seen as what we work to reduce. The World Bank deals with poverty reduction. So there seems to be a movement forward that we all need to work towards reducing inequalities. I think we have not come up with a consistent way to do that. So it's very difficult to achieve overnight the kind of policy coherence that everyone is calling for. However, I think it's very important that we start to work together. And I think that the IMF's social spending framework does call for, and it's a very welcome call, for the IMF to work increasingly with the international development institutions, which would include the ILO, to get the evidence base and to get the policies right. So we're very much looking forward to working together in that way.
Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Deborah Greenfield is the Deputy Director General for Policy at the International Labour Organization. You can watch a webcast of the seminar on helping countries strengthen social spending and find lots more on the topic, including a paper on IMF engagement on social spending at imf.org. And if you like this podcast, look for us on Spotify or your favorite podcast app. Just search for IMF Podcasts. You can also follow us on Twitter at IMF_podcast. Thanks for listening.